Welcome to the podcast about investing in startups, where existing investors can learn how to get the best deal possible, and those that have never before invested in startups can learn the keys to success from the venture experts. Your host is Nick Moran, and this is The Full Ratchet.
This is episode 2 of The Full Ratchet. I'm Nick Moran, and today Chris Yeh joins us for our very first guest interview on the podcast. As promised, we're going to start at the beginning. So if you're looking for complex deal structures or negotiation of exits, you're going to have to wait. And honestly, I think it's helpful for context to consider the big picture of venture before we go deeper in the various subtopics. Today, we'll cover questions like, what is venture capital? How are funds structured? How does the investment process work? And how do VCs and investors make money? This interview with Chris is packed with great information, so we'll be bumping right up against the hour mark. With that said, let's get right into it. Here's my interview on the topic, Intro to the Venture Capital Industry. Today, we are fortunate to have Chris Yeh. He is co-founder and general partner at Wasabi Ventures, and it also has a blog titled Adventures in Capitalism at chrisyeh.blogspot.com. If you don't know Chris, he is a really well-respected thought leader in the industry and is an absolute pleasure to have him with us. Chris, thanks so much for helping me kick things off with this topic of intro to venture.
No, thank you so much for having me, Nick. It's my pleasure to be here.
You've had an interesting journey prior to your current endeavor at Wasabi Ventures. Can you walk us through how you got into this startup investing world?
Absolutely. So I happened to graduate from college at the time when the internet was first taking off. This was 20 years ago now. I actually have my 20-year college reunion coming up. And so I went straight into the internet business. I was at a company called D.E. Shaw & Company. It is a major hedge fund that's still around today. And we were doing a number of internet startup activities, including Juno Online Services, which went public, and Farsight Financial Services, which got sold off to Merrill Lynch along the way. And so as a result, I'd gotten into the startup world, but I didn't know that much about venture capital. And I really learned about venture capital when I started my first company when I was in business school back in 1999. And that's when I first started doing my venture capital pitches and getting to know folks and so on and so forth. So I really got to know venture capital first from the perspective of an entrepreneur, somebody who'd raised money a number of times and done tons and tons of pitches. And then around 2005, a friend asked me to look at his company and give me some advice on his startup. And I liked it, and I said, hey, are you taking any money? And he said, as a matter of fact, I am. And so it was at that point that I made the transition and started doing investing in startups as well. And so that's been nearly a decade worth of startup investments, probably done about 40 to 50 of those startup investments. And that's gotten me a lot of exposure to venture capital from the investor side. I'm an angel investor for the most part, i.e. I'm investing in smaller companies at seed stage deals as opposed to Series A investments of $5 to $10 million. But obviously one of the major things I do to help my companies is to help them eventually connect with the right venture capitalists, find the right fund with the right fit so they can grow from there. So that's how I got into the venture business. I continue to spend a lot of time working with people in the venture community. And I do think it's really important what you're doing here in terms of educating people. When I was a young entrepreneur, I basically didn't know anything. And I had to pick up what I could. And back then, there wasn't nearly as much information. So I'm glad that you're contributing to the corpus of knowledge.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of folks that I've interacted with that that are hungry for knowledge. And the reality is, I don't hold it all. So I'm glad to have people like you to sort of help the audience walk through this process. But I've got to ask, Chris, did you make a placement in that first company that approached you?
So I made an investment in that first company, and it has not gone out of business, but it has not been successful. So despite that fact, I've continued going. Of course, some of the subsequent ones that I made turned out to be more successful than that. But that first company, I always have a soft spot for.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, I get advice from a lot of folks that say, don't make an investment in the first company you see, but it always seems like the way that you get into startup investing is you just find something that's special. So,
absolutely. And there's no class that you take to be an investor. I mean, investing typically works on a – venture firms work on an apprenticeship basis, and then angel investors are largely self-taught. So you just kind of have to go ahead and do it.
Right. So jumping into the topic. So as promised to the listeners, we're going to start at the beginning. So Chris, most simply, what is venture capital?
Venture capital is an asset class where venture capital firms or funds, as we typically call them, make long-term equity investments in startup companies. And it's important to note those three key factors: long-term equity investments in startup companies. Venture capital is investing for the long term. Venture capitalists invest money in a company and expect to get a return in maybe 5 to 10 years. It's a long process, and it takes investors who are very patient, as opposed to investors, typical retail investors, who are putting money in and out of stocks depending on who they are on an annual basis or weekly, monthly, daily basis. Who knows? Same for hedge funds. The second is their equity investments. So as a venture capitalist, you're investing in a company and betting on its success. You're not betting that the company will be able to repay you the money with interest, which is what a debt investor does. You're betting on, this is something that is going to fundamentally be a big outcome, and I'm going to make money by participating in the equity upside. Finally, the investments are being made in startup companies. So certainly venture capital could theoretically apply. You could have long-term equity investments in things that are not startups, things that are just traditional brick-and-mortar businesses, a dry cleaner or something like that. But that's typically the province of private equity, right? The thing that distinguishes venture capital from private equity is the emphasis on startup companies. And the reason why venture capitalists focus on startup companies is simple. Those are the ones which have the greatest variability of returns, that have the greatest opportunity to deliver the kind of outsized returns that really make a fund.
And with your experience, the startups that you've invested in, can you give us a sense for the longest time to return and the shortest time to return across the spectrum of investments?
Absolutely. So the shortest time to return I've ever had is one particular company. It was a Y Combinator company. I invested in it, and 6 months later, it was sold. So it does actually sometimes happen that you make an investment, and again, you intend to be in an investment for years, and within a year, you're actually getting a profit, which is nice. But the longest investment, as I said, that first investment that I made in 2005 is still going. So as a result, it's 9 years and counting, and God only knows when I'll actually get a return. So the time period ranges from months to never.
Right. I wish they could all be 6 months, but it's not the reality. Okay, so you talked about...
It even happens for big deals. I know that Greylock, for example, invested in Instagram just a couple of months before the Facebook acquisition. And to some extent, they would actually prefer that not to be the case. They would like to get a bigger win because, you know, they probably made double their money in 6 months, which I think you and I as investors, hey, we love that. But for a big fund to really move the needle, they want to make 50, 100 times their money.
Sure. It seems like there's sort of this second market opportunity for a lot of these major private equity and hedge fund players that's happening in later stages. But that's really a topic for another time. So you talked about venture capital as an asset class. Where does it fit in the spectrum of asset classes? You know, you've got public equities, you've got bonds, and you've got real estate and private equity. Where does it fit in?
So venture capital has typically been considered what's called an alternate investment strategy, i.e., it is hopefully less correlated with the public markets and the core holdings, tends to be a small part of the portfolio. One of the big things that caused the expansion of venture capital is in the 1980s and 1990s, certain large endowments like the Yale Endowment, for example, began investing more heavily in venture capital and getting strong returns. And so that actually led to a rejiggering of people's overall portfolio allocation towards these alternate investments. But venture capital continues to be mostly a small portion of people's overall portfolio of assets. Where it fits in is it's designed to be a small portion that could potentially deliver outsized returns that are typically uncorrelated. Now, the correlation does exist on some level because, for the most part, the majority of venture returns historically have come from taking companies public. And so if you're taking companies public, you are ultimately dependent on the public markets. But it is definitely the case that it is still less correlated than just investing straight into the stock market. So people invest in venture capital as a diversification play, as an absolute return play, and as a small portion of an overall portfolio.
You mentioned one of the primary exits is going public and IPOing. Can you give us a sense for what the major methods for people getting their money out are?
Sure. In the venture is actually very simple in comparison to things like private equity. In the venture world, you either have going public or you have M&A activity, mergers and acquisitions, selling the company to someone else. And there are no special dividends or other sorts of spin-outs or things like that that you might see in the private equity world. Venture world, you either sell the company or you sell the company to the public. And it historically was more selling the company to the public. More recently, perhaps because of Sarbanes-Oxley in the wake of the dot-com bubble, there's been a lot more M&A activity. It's also the case that with the presence of these sort of mega acquirers like Apple and Google that didn't necessarily exist, at least in their current forms in the 1990s, it makes sense that there's more M&A activity now. If you sell to Google or Apple, maybe you don't get quite as much, but you're certainly getting a very stable situation. You don't have to worry about keeping your stock price up, and it's generally a place where your people want to work.
Right. So there's a lot of folks I know that have significant investments in the public markets. So public equities, you mentioned Google, you mentioned Apple, very liquid, easy to invest in those. Can you talk about the similarities of venture investing, startup investing to public equity investing?
Got it. Well, you know, they're pretty much, it's not so much the similarities as the differences. The only similarity is that you're investing in the equity of a business, and that ultimately the return you get is dominated by the performance of that business, right? You can have short-term fluctuations in stock price. You can have short-term fluctuations in the animal spirits of the venture market that determine valuations. But ultimately, businesses have to be successful in order to be valuable. But there are so many differences. It's, like you said, venture investments are completely illiquid. There are some opportunities in the secondary markets, but those typically occur much later on. Venture investments are something where, you know, you have to wait a long time, where the securities are not priced for the most part. They're very rarely marked to market, and even when they are, there's no real meaning to it. And so you have to think about it in a completely different way. If you're investing in venture capital, you're basically saying, I'm allocating this amount of my portfolio to it, and I won't know the results for 10 years, versus public equities, where you can see the results on a daily basis.
Got it. So let's transition over into the venture fund. So we talked about venture capital as an asset class and industry. What is a venture fund?
Sure. So, and this is an interesting point that a lot of novices don't necessarily understand. A venture capital firm actually consists of many legal entities. So there are two primary things you need to be concerned about. The first is the management company. So the management company is a legal entity to which the partners of the venture capital firm belong. And the management company pays their salaries. The management company does all these different things. And it is the ownership of the venture firm. There are no limited partners in the management company. The management company is owned by the partners of the venture firm itself. And so you could think of the management company as essentially, if a venture firm were a startup, the management company is that startup entity. Now, the management company itself is the general partner of other funds. Those funds are individual limited liability corporation entities that raise a pool of money from investors and then invest that money into startups. So when you hear someone say, oh, Greylock just invested in company X, it's not that Greylock Management Company invested in Company X. It's that Greylock Management Company, in its role as the manager of Greylock 17, invested money out of Greylock 17 into that company. So a typical successful venture firm has numerous entities. Each individual fund is its own separate entity, has its own separate set of limited partners and investors, and makes its investments into the individual startups. The reason this is important is you have to understand the fund, the nature of the fund, to understand from an entrepreneur standpoint what that fund is likely to do. So the fact that a venture firm overall has a large amount of money doesn't necessarily help you if they invested in you out of a particular fund and that fund is out of money, because there are a lot of rules in place that say, hey, we're not going to invest in our other in previous companies out of new funds, because that's kind of a conflict of interest, a little self-dealing. So as a result, let's say you get invested in out of Fund 17. If Fund 17 is out of money, it's hard; they're hard-pressed to put more money in. And so knowing the fund management company and knowing the individual funds themselves and the nature of their relationships, how long they've run, how much money there is, what we call dry powder in the industry, is really critical.
Got it. So if I'm a new investor, and let's use Greylock as an example, I've heard that Greylock has had fantastic performance. I know some other investors there. I believe in their general philosophy as a management company. And I approach Greylock, and let's say they have two different funds that are open for investment, Fund A and Fund B. What should I think about, and what questions should I ask before making an investment in one of those funds?
Well, if you're a limited partner, you can't actually get into the funds after they've been set up. You basically have to come in at the very beginning. So once a fund is in progress, like let's say here's the fund that has Facebook in it. Well, of course, everyone would want to buy into it. But guess what? None of the existing investors are going to want to share any of that. And so you have to have committed up front. That's why venture funds raise these separate entities. And when they raise their next entity, they basically say, look at how our previous funds performed. Do you want in or not? And only after everyone's committed do they close the fund and actually take in investors. And they typically don't add investors after the fact. If you're an entrepreneur and you have a choice between a couple of open funds, a couple of funds that are existing, then what you really want to do is you want to say, okay, well, which one has the most dry powder? Now, if there are funds that are in the process of being raised, let's say a venture firm is raising two funds at the same time.
Right, that's what
well,
I was driving.
Typically, they're going to have, exactly, so I'm covering all the cases. Typically, a venture fund that's raising two funds at the same time, the two funds will have very different philosophies. So one may be a traditional venture fund focused on early stage startups, and the other may be a growth equity fund that focuses on putting larger amounts of money into startups that are further along. This is one of the ways in which they may actually support their earlier investments, and it's okay. It's not a conflict of interest in that case because it's specifically a growth equity fund that's designed for that situation, and the limited partners have signed off on it. So ultimately, you have to decide which philosophy you want to follow. Are you interested in something that is an early stage venture fund? Are you interested in something that's growth equity? Are you interested in something that's really tightly focused, like maybe it's a Bitcoin fund or something like that? It's essentially like looking at a mutual fund, except you have no performance to look at. You have to just look at the investment philosophy and style.
Got it. So we've touched on a few of these points, but what would be a fund's key functions?
Certainly. So the key functions of the management company are, in fact, to raise the funds. And the management company, the partners will go on out to meet with various limited partners, LPs, pension funds, and family offices and the like, and present to them and say, here's what we're doing, and here's why you should write us a check. And they go ahead and they pick up those commitments. The individual fund itself has specific things that it needs to do. And the individual fund includes a set of partners. So, for example, you know, Fund 17 may have different partners than Fund 18. The partners can actually change from fund to fund. The individual general partners of those funds are going to go ahead and find the startups to invest in, take board seats, and hopefully monitor the company and add value to them, and ultimately help that company generate an exit. So once you get down to the level of the individual fund itself, it really falls on the general partners to select investments, and make those investments successful.
Great. So from the time an investor first identifies a startup to when they make an actual investment, can you walk us through the process of what happens in between?
Certainly. And this will just be sort of the most generic a version of it. Certainly, things can always take interesting twists and turns, but I'll cover the straight and narrow classic case. So an investor identifies a startup. Maybe they read about it, or more likely, a friend of theirs who's an entrepreneur that they've invested in the past says, hey, you should check out this company. That's actually the single best way to get introduced to a venture firm, get introduced by one of their entrepreneurs, because if it's someone they've bet on already, that means they respect their judgment and they're interested in getting additional deals through them. In fact, some funds like Sequoia, for example, have the equivalent of a scout fund where they allow their entrepreneurs to actually invest money that Sequoia gives to them. So Sequoia gives them the money. They invest it in the companies. They keep all the returns. Sequoia doesn't even get the returns back. Sequoia is just looking for early intelligence on which companies might be worth investing in.
So interesting.
Partner identifies a startup. They found out about through whatever means. They'll usually schedule a screening call or a first meeting. And this may be the individual general partner doing it, or maybe in a principal or an associate. The general function of the associates is to churn through as many meetings as possible and act as the human filter to try to find interesting deals. But let's say it's a general partner, takes the meeting, talks to the entrepreneur on the phone, or has the entrepreneur come in and visit, or more rarely, but more wisely, in my opinion, goes out and visits the entrepreneur and sees the entrepreneur in his or her natural habitat. Assuming the general partner is interested in what's going on, he or she may then say, well, let's do a deeper dive. Let's bring you in for a second meeting. I really want to dive into things now. The first meeting was for me to get to know you, for you to go through your presentation. The next meeting is more of a workshop. I want to dive into the specific questions and examples that I have. And instead of taking half an hour to an hour, I want to take 2 hours. I really want to dig. And maybe at this point I also bring in an associate or a principal, maybe some subject matter experts, maybe an entrepreneur from the portfolio to help me figure out, do I think that this is worthwhile? And the reason why the general partner is doing all this work is, A, trying to figure out if it's worth investing in, and B, ultimately, most venture funds are run on a quasi-consensus basis. There is a partner meeting where the various general partners are going to get together and present their potential investments to each other to get feedback. Sometimes there's a vote, sometimes there isn't, but regardless, you need to be able to sell the deal to the other partners. So as you're an entrepreneur, you've done the second meeting, you're like, I'm feeling pretty good, the venture capitalists are saying good things. After the second meeting, the venture capitalist is probably doing some light due diligence. They're saying, hey, I want to talk to some of your customers. Maybe they're talking to other friends in the industry and say, what do you think of this product? Is it something you would use? And so there's a whole process that goes on for the venture capitalist to convince him or herself that this is worth doing. Assuming that he or she does that, then they take it to the partner meeting and say, here's the investment thesis. And you can actually find these online. For example, there's a fascinating one that was leaked. It's the investment thesis that Roelof Botha put together for investing in YouTube, which is pretty interesting, right?
Right, yeah, I saw that a couple weeks ago.
And so he writes up why he thinks YouTube is going to be successful, and that's the memo he circulates to the other people at Sequoia to get their buy-in on doing the deal. Oftentimes, after you've maybe circulated a memo or socialized the deal, as the expression goes, and they'll say, hey, looks pretty interesting. We want to meet this guy or gal face-to-face and see if we want to put the money in. And so probably one of the big points is when the entrepreneur is invited in to present at the partner meeting. So if you've gotten to the partner meeting and you're presenting at the partner meeting, that's a big deal, right? That investor has put his or her credibility on the line and has brought you in to talk to folks, and this is kind of a make-or-break meeting. And so if you convince them that it makes sense, then they'll go into due diligence. They'll say, hey, let's write up a term sheet, let's do some due diligence, and at that point, they'll really dig. They'll ask for tons of documents and information to make sure that all the things you're saying are true and make sure there are no hidden landmines. This involves looking at things like legal contracts. Hey, you know, can your customers all just ask for a refund at any time? What minds might be there? And assuming that you pass the due diligence, and again, they'll try to do it relatively quickly, that's when the investment actually occurs. So it's a long process, and there's a lot more that goes on that the entrepreneur isn't aware of. The entrepreneur may think, hey, I attend a couple of meetings, and they make a decision, but there's actually a ton of work that goes on in the background. Venture capitalists probably don't work as hard as entrepreneurs, just because entrepreneurs are maniacs, but venture capitalists certainly aren't just sort of kicking back and saying, oh, yeah, sure, let me invest in that one. That sounds good.
Right. Sounds pretty involved, and it's a good testament to why you should trust a top-tier venture capitalist with your investments. But that's really where the fun begins, right? You make the placement, and then comes mentoring and governance and monitoring. So exactly. Anyway, moving right along, how do investors make money? So you talked about LPs, i.e. limited partners. So this could be a retail investor like you or me, right? Just a high net worth individual. Could be a institutional investor, right? Like a pension fund or an endowment of sorts.
Certainly.
How do these LPs, how do these investors make money?
Well, what the investors are doing when they buy into the fund is they're buying a share of ownership in all the things that the fund owns. And the fund is going out and taking their capital and using it to purchase pieces of various startups. Hopefully some of those startups are successful. When a startup goes public or is sold, the fund entity gets the shares or gets the money. And it's at that point that the venture firm has to make a decision on when to distribute the proceeds. So this is actually an interesting point. There are cases where the venture firm says, you know, I'm not going to distribute it yet. Maybe I distribute everything at the end of the year. And other venture firms may say, wow, this was a huge sale. We've got all this cash on hand. Let's distribute it as quickly as possible to the limited partners. Limited partners tend to prefer the latter to the former, i.e., hey, if you just took a company public and it's worth $3 billion right now, I want to get those shares.
Sure.
Come on, send it my way.
Their money's been in long enough, right?
Exactly. I want to make a decision as to whether I sell or keep. I don't want you making that decision. Your decision was, which startup should I invest in, not when should I sell a publicly traded stock. But, you know, other venture firms see it differently. They may say, you know what, we're going to wait until after the lockup expires before we distribute, because you can't sell it anyways. Or, for convenience's sake, we're going to do everything at the end of the year. But the investors make their money by having the investments in the fund be successful and having the venture firm make the appropriate distributions. When finally all monies have been distributed and all investments have been wound down, then the fund itself is finally closed as an entity. It's not left to linger forever. The venture firm itself may live on for decades, but an individual fund typically has a lifetime of about 10 years because, you know, during that time, the venture firm will get to, and I think this is your next question, that fund entity itself is paying the management company. And so as a result, you know, the investors themselves are going to be like, eventually there's no money left. The management company's not going to make any money. It's better for everyone just to go ahead and close it up and tie a bow on it.
Can you talk more about how the general partners, so how the venture firm and the practitioners at that firm make money?
Absolutely. So typically, venture firms operate on the same general principle as private equity and hedge funds. Somehow, Wall Street has convinced people to take the same formula. I actually think it's unfair to venture capitalists because they're probably underpaid relative to private equity investors or hedge fund investors. The basic structure is what we call 2 and 20. So a 2% per year management fee and a 20% carried interest, or carry, as people typically talk about it. The way it works is this. Let's say you have a $100 million fund. That fund is going to have a 10-year lifetime. And what that means is that, and again, this can vary. Sometimes it's straight line. Sometimes it's the distribution is actually different. But it usually ends up being, for the 10-year life of the firm, each year 2% is going to be paid as a management fee. And so that ends up being $2 million per year or $20 million over the lifetime of the fund. As I said, sometimes the distribution is changed such that more of the money is paid out at the beginning than at the end. Other times it's just done in a straight line for simplicity's sake. It really depends on the deal that the venture capitalists decide to offer to their LPs. Now, that money can be significant. Like I said, for a $100 million fund, that's $20 million over the lifetime of the fund. For a $1 billion fund, that's $200 million over the lifetime of the fund. And this is largely why there's always pressure on venture firms to raise larger and larger amounts of money, because the economics say that your management fees are going to increase in proportion with the size of the fund. And that's why private equity guys and hedge fund guys with their multi-billion dollar funds often have an easier time of it than venture capitalists. A venture capitalist, you know, might be running a $100 million fund and spending just as much time on that as a hedge fund guy running a $10 billion fund. And yet the hedge fund guy is making $200 million a year and off of management fees, and the venture capitalist is making $2 million a year. Big difference.
Yeah.
But where the venture capitalists eventually may come around and become billionaires, and a number of venture capitalists like John Doerr actually are billionaires, is the carried interest. The carried interest essentially says that this is the proportion of the profits from the fund that I get as an investor. So the thing about a venture investment is, let's say you invest in Google or Facebook. Well, all of a sudden, your $100 million fund returns $2 billion or $3 billion. Wow. And now of those profits, let's say, to make math easy, let's just say it returned $2.1 billion. on a $100 million fund. Now you have $2 billion in profits. Well, 20% of those profits, that's $400 million. Now we're talking some real money. And so the reason why investors like that is that typically the venture capitalists can only really get rich if they succeed. And so they only really get tons of money if they've also made the investors tons of money. There are some complicating factors. Sometimes there's a hurdle rate. What the hurdle rate says is, hey, there is a time value of money. I'm not just paying you, you know, to go ahead and put this into T-bills or something like that. If you return, you know, 10% or 20%, I'm not giving you 20% of that upside because I could have gotten that myself just by putting the money into a treasuries. So there's a hurdle rate that may be based on the treasury rate or some other percentage or something like that that says the venture capitalist needs to make a certain amount of money first before the carried interest starts being applied.
And a lot of people describe the management fee portion as a loan. Why would they describe it that way?
That's an interesting question. I don't actually know the answer to that question. Describing it as a loan seems strange to me. I guess it's a loan in the sense that that's money that's going to allow the venture firm to continue to operate and pay its staff and do all those things while waiting. Basically, because the venture capitalist has to wait for the exits, much like the investors do, they need something to live on in the meantime. But it's not structured as a loan, so I'm not sure why people would necessarily consider it a loan. I guess you could consider it sort of an advance against the future profits.
Right. The example that another fella had brought up to me was the management fee is subtracted from the eventual carried interest. So while it does pay the administrative fees and the salaries on an ongoing basis, apparently once that fund delivers and pays the carry and a return out to investors, the sum of the management fees over the course of the fund is subtracted from that value?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Otherwise, it would be double dipping. The idea is, you know, come on, guys. That's considered part of the expenses of the fund and counts against profits. So if you had a $100 million fund and you returned, you know, $100 million, you made $120 million in the investment, but $20 million went to the $20 million went to the management fees, there would be no profit on the fund. As opposed to saying, oh, we had a $20 million profit, give me $4 million of that.
Yeah, right. So I wanted to quickly circle back to something you said. You had mentioned early on that you had an investment that's going on 9 years.
Yep.
And then more recently, you were talking about winding down a fund. So what happens if there are some stragglers? There are some investments that are lingering and they haven't delivered a return yet, but they're not necessarily bad investments that need to be wound down. What happens in that case?
Excellent question. So in that case, several things can happen. One thing that can happen is that the venture firm will just say, look, we're winding down the fund. We're just going to distribute the private stock to all of you LPs, and you deal with it from here. That's one option. The other option is the LPs may say, no, that's not that convenient. Can you keep the fund alive? We'll pay a little extra money in order for that to happen. And the third is to just say, okay, let's go ahead and just sell this off to a secondary buyer just to close out the fund. So ultimately, it's a negotiation between the fund itself and the limited partners as to what they want to do. Because obviously, you know, the second case where the limited partners, say, put up a little extra money to keep the fund alive, because it does cost money to keep a fund entity going, that's something where they would obviously have to agree to it.
So we've talked a lot about venture funds, venture capitalists as a part of this greater startup investing industry or venture investing industry. In a different episode, I'm going to go deep on angel investing, do an intro, you know, what is it? How does it work? But can you give us a little bit of color on where does angel investing fit in with all this? How is it similar or different than what we've already covered?
So angel investing tends to be a little different. The classic definition of an angel investor is somebody who's actually investing their own money. And so as a result, the economics are a little different. There's no management fee. There's no carry. You're just investing your own money, and it's up to you as an angel investor to decide, was the return I earned worth the time and capital that I committed? Now, typically, the angel investors go where VCs fear to tread. So angel investors are typically investing earlier stage, taking chances on people, coming in and providing the first money in. typically a company is not going to go straight to venture capitalists. It's going to start off with angel investors and then move to the venture capitalists. So the angel investors are a feeder system of companies to the venture capitalists. There's an interesting question as to whether angel investing is actually an economic activity. I would argue that it isn't, that usually people are doing angel investing for love, because they like being in the game, and that they actually don't earn a good return on their money in comparison to, for example, putting it in a venture fund and then just, you know, work, spending the time they would otherwise spend on angel investing working as a high-priced consultant, because typically an angel investor is a very accomplished person who can make a lot of money doing other things. But that being said, it's a wonderful thing to do. I mean, there's a reason why I do it. I tell people it's like belonging to the world's greatest country club. Instead of spending your time hanging out with boring people who talk about nothing but golf, you hang out with exciting people who talk about changing the world.
That's why we love it, right?
So
in this world, we've got venture capitalists, the practitioners themselves. We've got LPs that invest in a venture fund. And then we've got angels that are making investments in startups on their own, and it sounds like you do all three.
Yes, so I do. I go all across the board. I've sat on all sides of the table, and you know, again, I think it's useful to have the perspective of having done everything. I think that there's this big debate going on: are operators or people who've been in the startup world better investors than people who've never been CEOs? And now, I think that obviously you can be a great investor without being a CEO, but I think it helps to know what it feels like to sit in that big chair, just like it helps to know what it feels like to be an angel investor looking for a Series A to come in, just like it helps to know what the perspective of a VC is when they're trying to chase down the signatures from 17 different angel investors in order to get a deal closed. So I like to think that I have some empathy for all the people in the equation.
So as far as resources go, do you have anything that you would recommend on venture investing, startup investing for people that may have been doing this for a while but want better context on the industry itself, or people that are brand new to venture investing?
Certainly. So there are a couple of places that I typically point people to. I think that the two that I would generally focus them on, there is a site called Venture Hacks, which was created originally by Naval Ravikant and partners. And Naval is probably best known now as the founder of AngelList, which has obviously been enormously successful and has really revolutionized angel investing. I'm sure you'll get into that in your angel investing podcast. But it's a great resource. It's sort of one of the first sites to help demystify venture investing for entrepreneurs. The other thing that I would recommend, Brad Feld, who's a venture capitalist based in Colorado at the Foundry Fund. He's an outstanding venture capitalist and a good writer as well, which is why I like him. He has a book that he did with his partner Jason Mendelsohn called Venture Deals, Be Smarter Than Your Lawyer and Venture Capitalist, that talks through all the details. So Venture Deals is another great resource for people who say, I just want to pick up a book. You know, it costs like 15, 20 bucks, and it's certainly cheaper than getting an MBA.
Yeah, second book on the industry that I read. Fantastic book. Go check out Brad Feld. He's at www.feld.com. He runs a blog called Feld Thoughts, and you can certainly pick up his book there. Good. All right. So tell us more what you're currently up to at Wasabi.
Certainly. So what we're doing is something that we feel like is pretty exciting. We're trying to solve some of the problems that we see in early stage investing. And most of the problems that we see focus on not being able to get to know the team well enough, not being able to feel like there's a good problem being tackled. And so we actually have started what we call the Startup Academy, or WV Academy, which teaches entrepreneurs, free service, and people can come in and sign up over the web. It teaches entrepreneurs how we think about the world in terms of identifying good opportunities and how do you start a business and how do you do a startup. And again, this is a free class. We don't charge people anything for it. What we do is we pick out the people who are the top graduates of this class and we say, hey, maybe you'd like to work on a startup with us, and we'll provide you with support and guidance and help steer you towards a good idea and help get you to take that idea to the market and start generating some traction. Because one of the things that I always tell entrepreneurs is traction is the number one thing, key to fundraising. Unless you're already somebody who's super successful, in which case, why would you even be listening to what I have to say? Right? You'd just be out doing it. Traction is the best way to prove to venture capitalists that you know what you're doing. Every idea is crazy until it succeeds. Airbnb was crazy until it succeeded. Uber was crazy until it succeeded. The key is the success. And so we work with entrepreneurs to help identify what we think will be a very attractive market, help them get out into the market, and provide guidance to sort of grow them along the way. And the reason we're willing to do that is because of the Startup Academy, we've been able to get to know them and understand how they think. And we feel comfortable that this is the kind of person we want to build a long-term relationship with.
Interesting. I like the approach with the advisory and the incubation. Have you guys been doing that since the start, or has that been a...
Not since the start. It's something we've picked up more recently. There's a number of companies we've done this with now pretty successfully. At least so far, we've been able to have a good track record of doing this and then being able to raise outside investment for the company. So we did this for a company called ApplyKit in the college application management space, and another company called Square One Mail, which is in the email and sales productivity space. So we are continuing to do this. We're teaching a class right now. I actually had a class yesterday that I was teaching on how to become an authority, which is a very important thing as an entrepreneur.
So, of course, you guys are located in the Bay Area, a hotbed of innovation. So tell me about how the environment is currently and how has it evolved?
Certainly. Well, obviously, Silicon Valley and the Bay Area are the hotbed of the technology startup world. And there are a few things that have changed. Obviously, the proliferation of angel investments and super angels and investors via AngelList has made it a lot easier to raise small amounts of money. I would guess that there are more companies being started than ever before, especially because there's so many people out educating folks and talking. And any given night of the week, you can go attend and see some legendary investor or entrepreneur talking. So there's just a tremendous amount of excitement. I think that, you know, in terms of Silicon Valley versus the rest of the world, there's an upside and a downside. The upside is it's easier for people to go ahead and get a company started. The downside is it's easier for people to go ahead and get a company started. There's tons of competition. If I go to a coffee shop in Palo Alto, for example, that a lot of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs hang out at, they'll have 17 different sort of point-of-sale services that they're trying out because everyone has gone to them and said, hey, can you try this out? We'll give you some shares.
Right.
And so it ends up being something where how do you differentiate your company from the other 72 companies that the investor saw the previous week that are doing the same thing? That definitely makes it a challenge. One of the things we do, I'm based here in the Bay Area, but TK, my partner, splits his time between New England and the D.C. Baltimore area. And one of the reasons that we do that, besides the fact that he happens to live out there and grew up on the East Coast, is that oftentimes we find our entrepreneurs out on the East Coast and other places that maybe aren't as well served, help polish them up and get them up and running, and then bring them to the Bay Area so that they can come here with traction and then raise money from where the capital is more plentiful.
Interesting. Yeah. It's always amazing to me how many Me Too's can pop up and maybe have even an inferior product to something that already exists, but maybe a better sales and marketing plan or better channel access and get more traction that way. So things move quickly.
I can't remember which famous Hollywood figure said this, but I believe that he said, nobody knows anything. And it's an exaggeration. There's certainly people who seem to have been able to deliver outstanding returns over time, but I think it's good for all of us to have a healthy humility about our ability to predict what will work. As I was fond of telling people, you know, I just pick whatever is hot at the time. Like for a significant period of time, that was Snapchat, and I would tell people, hey, if 18 months ago I went to you and said, I've got a great product for you. It is a product that allows me to send pictures that self-destruct. And the whole idea behind it is that most people are going to start off using it to send pictures of their genitalia. And I want you to give me $20 million. They'd be laughed out of the room.
Yeah.
They come back later. Hey, we've got 100 million downloads and people using it every day. Oh, guess what? Darn smartphones.
Yeah, not sure what happened there. I think it dropped.
So I think I probably had just finished off my little story about Secret, which was to say people wouldn't invest in something if they just heard the idea, but do invest once they see it's successful. They want to hop onto a bandwagon.
Right, right. So if we could cover any topic on venture investing in the startup world, what topic do you think we should address and who would you like to hear speak about it?
You know, I think what I would love to see, and probably you try to get some founders to speak about this, is just talk about how unimportant fundraising is in comparison to building the business. And we're guilty of this ourselves because we're investors, and so fundraising is obviously important to us. But when I see an entrepreneur who's obsessed with fundraising and figuring out how the perfect way to raise the round or the perfect way to optimize the financing round, I think that's totally the wrong emphasis. The emphasis should be on building a great product and being able to build a business based on that product. And so, you know, really getting some successful entrepreneurs to talk about just how much people overemphasize fundraising, I think would be useful.
Yeah, some of the best opportunities I'm looking at now, I have to chase down because the founders are they're doing well and they're making money and they're busy and don't have a tremendous amount of time to fundraise or think about cap tables and valuation and whatnot. So,
yeah, exactly. Like somehow it's the guys who aren't successful that seem to have the most time to think about that.
Yeah, right. Cool. So for someone who's new to startup investing, what advice would you give?
Probably the biggest advice I'd give is to go ahead and start off doing it. Do it with money that you can afford to lose, because you're probably going to lose a bunch of it. I know I have. But it's really hard to, you can listen to podcasts like this, and I think it helps a lot, but it's different. It's like listening to a podcast about how to play blackjack and then sitting there and putting $1,000 on a hand. Totally different feel. You have to actually do it in order to really understand how it's going to work. And so, you know, maybe you start small. You don't have to invest a huge amount of money, but putting your own money into it is one of the things I strongly recommend. I think that's the thing that's going to tell you, okay, can I deal with the uncertainty? Can I deal with the fact that I'm going to lose money?
Yeah. A mentor of mine told me, get off the sideline and get in the game. So a year ago, I decided to leave my job and start doing this full time because he was right. You really got to immerse yourself and you got to start making investments to learn what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong.
Well, absolutely. It's great advice.
Well, great. So Chris, what's the best way for listeners to connect with you?
Well, what they should probably go ahead and do is follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is just at Chris Yeh, ChrisYeh. They can certainly find me in any variety of other places. The good news about being me is that I have, over the past decade or two, built up my Google presence to the point where if you Google Chris Yeh, you're going to find me. So you'll find plenty of places to pick out my presence and my content. One other note, I do have a book coming out July 8th. It's a book that I co-authored with Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, and of course a partner at Greylock, along with my friend Ben Kaznilka, who is his chief of staff. So if you go to our book website, which is thealliancedframework.com, you can learn about that book, which is all about the future of work, and maybe pre-order a couple of copies.
Great. I didn't realize that. That's good news. I can't wait to read the book. Well, certainly in the limited time I've known you, Chris, you've been insightful about the industry. You've been as generous with your time as anyone. Huge thanks for sharing your thoughts with the listeners and for giving us your time today. Give him a follow. Chris is on Twitter. He's at Chris Yeh. Check out his Adventures in Capitalism blog over at chrisyeh.blogspot.com. And of course, Wasabi Ventures, which is www.wasabiventures.com. And look out for that new book. Chris, thanks again for being with us and hope to have you back soon.
Truly a pleasure, Nick. Looking forward to the next time.
Hope you guys enjoyed the interview. Lots of great material covered on the show today. And I wanted to highlight a few key things that we discussed. Chris talked about how the only real similarity between venture investing and public stock investing is that you're investing in equity of a business, and your return is dominated by the performance of that business. The key differences to be aware of are liquidity, market price and value transparency, and that results can be determined immediately in the public markets versus the long time horizons before an exit in venture. These are very different asset classes. So remember that if you're new to this and you haven't taken the time to really learn how it works, it's very easy to lose your entire investment. All right, number two is we talked about the startup investment process for VCs consisting of 7 stages. So to recap those, number one was identification of the startup. Number two was an initial screening, so getting to know the entrepreneur and the basics of the business. Number three was a second screening. So this is a deeper dive, maybe a workshop, specific Q&A, and can include multiple representatives from the firm, maybe even subject matter experts, and or trusted entrepreneurs in the VC's portfolio. Number four was light due diligence. Number five was the partner meeting, which could be in person. It could be a circulated memo where the investment thesis is presented, where you're, quote, socializing the deal. Number six is the entrepreneur is invited to present at the partner meeting. And number seven was terms and due diligence. I mentioned on episode one that this is a more involved process than Shark Tank. And if you're making investments in startups, think about how the experts are doing it. Will you have a partner meeting as an individual? Probably not. But it's not difficult to get together with a small group of friends, business executives, and/or angels in your area and help each other evaluate. Again, a huge part of the business is dodging bullets. So if someone you trust sees something that you don't and it poses a significant risk, that can be very helpful. All right, the third thing I wanted to recap is Chris had an interesting take on the fees for VCs. So he mentioned how the standard fee structure for venture funds is 2 and 20. And for many smaller VC funds, sometimes you see that management fee tends to be a little higher, 2.5%, 3%. But the key point here is that venture fund managers only really do well financially if they do well for the fund and its investors. Different than PE or hedge funds, where the management fees alone make many rich, regardless of their performance. So that's a key differentiation. The message is not to avoid other asset classes and funds. We all need to diversify. But in an investment world of misaligned incentives, it's refreshing to hear that venture's an asset class where the professionals only do well when the investor does. Okay, we'll finish up with a tip of the week. The tip for this episode is to have a strategy or a focus when it comes to startups that you invest in, whether that be geographic, an industry vertical, product versus service-based businesses, software versus hardware, whatever the case, having some background or domain expertise in a field, market, or application should help tremendously when evaluating early-stage companies in that area. Whether you're 20 or 80 years old, we all have knowledge and experience in certain areas that should be leveraged. That said, your focus doesn't have to be super narrow, to the level where you have one startup in 20 that you can even consider. But I'd also suggest it not be too broad, such as, we invest in tech. If that's the case, you could make the argument that any startup is in your area of expertise. The advantage, of course, to having strategic focus is that you'll eliminate opportunities quickly. And with the ones that do fit, you'll be able to evaluate them quick and more effectively. And overall, you should have greater confidence in your decisions. And make sure to use your network of subject matter experts. Recently, I reviewed a very strong startup in the renewable energy trading space. And while I've had some exposure to that field, that is not square in my core. So I pulled in a buddy for some Q&A with the founder and was much better able to understand the industry dynamics and the growth potential for the startup. So consider your experience and figure out those areas that you're going to differentiate and have an advantage over other startup investors. Okay, that's it for this week. Look out for my next episode on the topic Angel Investing 101 with David S. Rose. He's a very accomplished investor, angel group leader, and author, so I think you'll find the interview very informative. Give me a follow on Twitter at The Full Ratchet. Jump on the website, it's fullratchet.net, and sign up for the newsletter, propose guests and topics, or reach out to me directly if you want to chat about a deal you're working on. All right, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and always remember, over-prepare, choose carefully, and invest confidently. See you next week.